Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an Asian, see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Black won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control buildings and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folks got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisoners in the United States are black people. You know you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, who cares? Marching, they never changed anything.
You were the first in this family to get into college.
I'm so proud of you.
I can't go, can I? I just can't afford to send you.
You didn't mean to let you down.
I understand. Maybe next year. Maybe. Hard-working students deserve a chance. Please, support the United Negro College Fund. A mind is a terrible thing to waste.
In System D, this is a store. And what I mean by that is that this is a photograph I took in Makoko shantytown in Lagos, Nigeria. It's built over the lagoon, and there are no streets where there can be stores to shop, and so the store comes to you. And in the same community, this is business synergy. This is the boat that lady was paddling around in, and this artisan makes the boat and the paddles and sells directly to the people who need the boat and the paddles. And this is a global business. Ogundairo smokes fish in Makoko in Lagos. And I asked her, where does this fish come from? And I thought she'd say, up the lagoon somewhere or maybe across Africa. But you'll be happy to know she said it came from here. It comes from the North Sea. It's caught here, frozen, shipped down to Lagos, smoked, and sold for a tiny increment of profit on the streets of Lagos. And this is a business incubator. This is Olasosun Dump, the largest garbage dump in Lagos, and 2,000 people work here. And I found this out from this fellow, Andrew Saburu. Andrew spent 16 years scavenging materials on the dump, earned enough money to turn himself into a contract scaler, which meant he carried the scale and went around and weighed all the materials that people had scavenged from the dump. Now, he's a scrap dealer. That's his little depot behind him. And he earns twice the Nigerian minimum wage. This is a shopping mall. This is Oshodi Market in Lagos. Jorge Luis Borges had a story called The Aleph, and The Aleph is a point in the world where absolutely everything exists. And for me, this image is a point in the world where absolutely everything exists. So what am I talking about when I talk about System D? It's traditionally called the informal economy, the underground economy, the black market. I don't conceive of it that way. I think it's really important to understand that something like this is totally open. It's right there for you to find. All of this is happening openly and above board. There's nothing underground about it. It's our prejudgment that it's underground. I've pirated the term System D from the former French colonies. There's a word in French that is débrouillardise, that means to be self-reliant. And the former French colonies have turned that into System D for the economy of self-reliance or the DIY economy. But governments hate the DIY economy. And that's why I took this picture in 2007, and this is the same market in 2009. And I think when the organizers of this conference were talking about radical openness, they didn't mean that the streets should be open and the people should be gone. I think what we have is a pickle problem. I had a friend who worked at a pickle factory, and the cucumbers would come flying down this conveyor belt, and his job was to pick off the ones that didn't look so good and throw them in a bin labeled relish where they'd be crushed and mixed with vinegar and used for other kinds of profit. This is the pickle economy. We're all focusing on, this is a statistic from earlier this month in the Financial Times, we're all focusing on the luxury economy. It's worth $1.5 trillion every year, and that's a vast amount of money, right? It's three times the gross domestic product of Switzerland. So it's vast. But it should come with an asterisk. And the asterisk is that it excludes two-thirds of the workers of the world. 1.8 billion people around the world work in the economy that is unregulated and informal. It's a huge number. And what does that mean? Well, it means if it were united in a single political system, one country, call it the United Street Sellers Republic, the USSR, or Bazaaristan, it would be worth $10 trillion every year. And that would make it the second largest economy in the world after the United States. And given that projections are that the bulk of economic growth over the next 15 years will come from emerging economies in the developing world, it could easily overtake the United States and become the largest economy in the world. So the implications of that are vast, because it means that this is where employment is, 1.8 billion people, and this is where we can create a more egalitarian world because people are actually able to earn money and live and thrive, as Andrew Saburu did. Big businesses have recognized this. And what's fascinating about this slide, it's not that the guys can carry boxes on their heads and run around without dropping them off. It's that the Gala sausage roll is a product that's made by a global company called UAC Foods that's active throughout Africa and the Middle East. But the Gala sausage roll is not sold in stores. UAC Foods has recognized that it won't sell if it's in stores. It's only sold by a phalanx of street hawkers who run around the streets of Lagos at bus stations and in traffic jams and sell it as a snack. And it's been sold that way for 40 years. It's a business plan for a corporation. And it's not just in Africa. Here's Mr. Clean looking amorously at all the other Procter & Gamble products. And Procter & Gamble, you know, the statistic always cited is that Walmart is their largest customer. And it's true as one store, Walmart buys 15%, does 15% of Procter & Gamble's businesses with Walmart. But Their largest market segment is something that they call high-frequency stores, which is all these tiny kiosks and the lady in the canoe and all these other businesses that exist in System D, the informal economy. And Procter & Gamble makes 20% of its money from that market segment, and it's the only market segment that's growing. So Procter & Gamble says, we don't care whether a store is incorporated or registered or anything like that. We want our products in that store. And then there's mobile phones. This is an ad for MTN, which is a South African multinational active in about 25 countries. And when they came into Nigeria, Nigeria is the big dog in Africa. 1 in 7 Africans is a Nigerian. And so everyone wants into the mobile phone market in Nigeria. And when MTN came in, they wanted to sell them mobile service like I get in the United States or like people get here in the UK or in Europe. Expensive monthly plans, you get a phone, you pay overages, you're killed with fees. And their plan crashed and burned. And they went back to the drawing board and they retooled and they came up with another plan. We don't sell you the phone, we don't sell you the monthly plan, we only sell you airtime. And where's the airtime sold? It's sold at umbrella stands all over the streets where people are unregistered, unlicensed, but MTN makes most of its profits, perhaps 90% of its profits, from selling through System D, the informal economy. And where do the phones come from? Well, they come from here. This is in Guangzhou, China. And if you go upstairs in this rather sleepy-looking electronics mall, you find the Guangzhou Dashato Secondhand Trade Center. And if you go in there, you follow the guys with the muscles who are carrying the boxes. And where are they going? They're going to Eddy in Lagos. Now, most of the phones there are not secondhand at all. The name is a misnomer. Most of them are pirated. They have the name brand on them, but they're not manufactured by the name brand. Now, are there downsides to that? Well, I guess, you know, China has no intellectual property, right? Versace without the vowels, Joe Money instead of Armani, S. Gucci. And all around the world, this is how products are being distributed. So for instance, in one street market on Rua 25 de Março in São Paulo, Brazil, you can buy fake designer glasses, you can buy cloned cologne, you can buy pirated DVDs, of course, you can buy New York Yankees caps and all sorts of unauthorized patterns, you can buy cuecas baratas, designer underwear that isn't really manufactured by a designer, and even pirated evangelical mixtapes. Now, businesses tend to complain about this, and I don't want to take away from their entire validity of complaining about it, but I did ask a major sneaker manufacturer earlier this year what they thought about piracy. And they told me, well, you can't quote me on this because if you quote me on this, I have to kill you. But they use piracy as market research. The sneaker manufacturer told me that if they find that Pumas are being pirated or Adidas are being pirated and their sneakers aren't being pirated, they know they've done something wrong. So it's very important to them to track piracy exactly because of this. And the people who are buying the pirates are not their customers anyway because their customers want the real deal. Now, there's another problem. This is a real street sign in Lagos, Nigeria. All of System D really doesn't pay taxes, right? And when I think about that, first of all, I think the government is a social contract between the people and the government. And if the government isn't transparent, then the people aren't going to be transparent either. But also that we're blaming the little guy who doesn't pay his taxes, and we're not recognizing that everyone's fudging things all over the world, including some extremely respected businesses, and I'll give you one example. There was one company that paid 4,000 bribes in the first decade of this millennium, and $1 million in bribes every business day, right? All over the world. And that company was the big German electronics giant, Siemens. So this goes on in the formal economy as well as the informal economy. So it's wrong of us to blame. And I'm not singling out Siemens. I'm saying everyone does it. Okay? I just want to end by saying that If Adam Smith had framed out a theory of the flea market instead of the free market, what would be some of the principles? First, it would be to understand that it could be considered a cooperative, and this is a thought from the Brazilian legal scholar Roberto Mangabeira Unger. Cooperative development is a way forward. Secondly, from the Swiss anarchist philosopher Paul Feyerabend, facts are relative, and what is a massive right of self-reliance to a Nigerian business person is considered unauthorized and horrible to other people. And we have to recognize that there are a difference in how people define things and what their facts are. And third is, and I'm taking this from the great American beat poet Allen Ginsberg, that alternate economies, barter and different kinds of currency, alternate currencies, are also very important. And he talked about buying what he needed just with his good looks. And so I just want to leave you there and say that this economy is a tremendous force for global development, and we need to think about it that way. Thank you very much.
It was almost 2 years ago that I started work on a small log cabin in the northern Canadian bush. And it has been exactly a year since I closed the cabin door for the last time and moved away. Finally, I got the chance to return, and I am anxious to see how the cabin has fared the last 4 seasons on its own. While most parts of North America are enjoying mild spring weather with no snow, my aluminum snowshoes are falling through waist-deep powder and temperatures of minus 20 degrees Celsius. Although this looks like January weather, would you believe that this is late April? It's been a long, hard winter here. Lots of snow and a solid month of minus 40 degree temperatures. There were even a few days that registered right around minus 50. It seems that the lynx population has been hit the hardest this winter. Several locals have reported that their dogs have been attacked by lynx along the hiking trails. Normally, lynx avoid this sort of contact with bigger dogs and humans, but the prolonged cold temperatures have forced them to make desperate decisions. It wasn't far from here that I spotted a mother lynx and her two cubs last year. And of course, I didn't have my camera ready at the time. On my way into the cabin, yet another lynx had silently stalked behind me for a short distance, but it eventually turned off my path and took a different direction. And I wouldn't have noticed it at all if it weren't for the footprints it left behind over my fresh tracks. In building the cabin, I wanted it to be simple for two reasons. Number one, because of the cabin's location, I knew that I'd be having to do everything by hand. Getting the equipment and supplies in, moving and hoisting the logs, would all have to be done with good old-fashioned manpower. And reason number two, I didn't have a lot of money to work with. Simple as that. And in this complicated world, simple just seems to offer more. Complicated offers bells and whistles, but simple. Simple offers freedom. Although some would argue that this cabin wasn't built to code, it is still perfectly legal. That's because it's built on privately owned property, and the local government doesn't require a permit for any structure that is 10 feet by 10 feet or under. And this log cabin just so happens to be exactly 10 feet by 10 feet. So yes, I'm aware that building my logs right on the ground without proper footings and not debarking them means that they will not last a whole century, like they could have if I had done all these things. But that's just fine. These logs will probably last at least a quarter century without any need for repairs. And so far, the cabin has settled and dried out quite nicely, and the bottom rows don't show any signs of rotting in the near future. I am also aware that I'm using a tarp to cover the roof, and contrary to popular belief, it is not instantly disintegrated or even began to fade yet. Besides, tarps can be replaced easily enough, and at low cost, so even if I have to replace it every 5 to 10 years or so, it won't be a problem. I'll just make sure to buy the heavy-duty kind. And yes, I know that there are gaps in my door, and that it most definitely isn't bear-proof, but in the wintertime, when there's a draft, I just place a blanket over the door and it stays quite warm and cozy inside. As for the bears, I haven't had any try to come inside yet, and if they do, they're not going to find it too terribly interesting. There's no food, and I didn't leave any fine china behind for Mr. Bear to break. Anyway, I like the door, and so it stays, gaps and all. Did I mention that it used to be a coffee table? My point is, there will always be some who will find fault in this simple design, but all I know is that it works for me. And at the end of it all, I only spent about $500 on the entire cabin, and most of that money went into the lumber I used in the roof. If I wasn't planning on moving at the time, I would have taken longer to construct the roof out of smaller logs, which would have significantly brought down the cost that much more. But I don't regret a single decision I made in the cabin's construction. Upon entering the cabin, I could see signs that there had been a visitor in my absence. A couple wads of insulation along the top logs and a pile of pine nuts on the shelf told me that a squirrel had stopped by for a visit at some point. Oh well, no harm done. It wasn't anything that 15 minutes of dusting couldn't fix. When I stepped back outside, I was surprised to see an old friend. Meet Charles. When I first started building the cabin, Charles would always fly past between 10:30 and 11:30 a.m. every morning. He always flew toward the west, and he was always 100 meters to the south of me. It was his morning routine. After a while, instead of simply flying past, Charles would break from his scheduled flight plan to circle overhead a few times. I figured it was his way of saying hello. Eventually, when Charles came overhead my little clearing in the bush, he would stop to land on a nearby tree to watch as I worked, and in this way we kept each other company. It was then that I named him Charles, and this is how our relationship continued until I moved away. Every day he'd come to visit between 10:30 and 11 a.m. He would caw and I would caw back at him. And so you can imagine how happy I was to see him again over a year later. He perched on a nearby tree when I arrived, and so I'd like to think that he recognized me. It's always good seeing an old friend, even if he is an old crow. So what started me on this simple cabin project? Well, I'm a youth pastor, and my church owns some bush property. And so I figured building a log cabin on the property would be a great project for my youth group to work together on. And although I worked alone most of the time, the youth would get together and join me on a Saturday from time to time, or for a couple hours after school. It was a great opportunity for them to learn new skills, make friends, and gain confidence in themselves. On other occasions, a friend would join me for an afternoon to help out. Sometimes there were people who I barely knew that wanted to lend a hand. So, if nothing else, I made a lot of good friends during the construction of this cabin. And so, when the cabin was complete, I donated it to the church and the youth group.
Now learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. And messed around, he saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah, I want to know what's in the door. He said, you sure you want to see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And in the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings. All of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you happen is when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt. I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on Pity Way. Your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places. I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad a cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer at the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles, the kid no one would pick, was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Okay, we're on
Tiny Town number 27 for us. We picked them randomly. You know, people pick these randomly, like, every day or so. But we're up to now Town 27. So we're on Perth, North Dakota. That's the town we're going to highlight today. Perth, North Dakota. Not Perth, Australia, but Perth, North Dakota. Population 6. It's on 83 acres. The economic engineer, or part of the economic engineer, is the Perth Journal, at least was, which is a newspaper. And the town's been around for over 100 years. And the town's economic engine, in part, probably more so than the Perth Journal, would be the informal economy, also known as the DIY, do-it-yourself economy. And before we get into Perth, let's get into Perth first. Let's get out that way. Lay the groundwork. Right, Perth economy. Excuse me, Perth. Perth, North Dakota. Perth, North Dakota. Perth is a city in Towner County, North Dakota, in the United States. The population was 6 people as of the 2020 census. Perth was founded in 1897, over 100 years old. Okay. It is not to be confused with Perth, Scotland, or Perth, Perth, Australia, which is in Western Australia. Perth, North Dakota, had, past tense, a newspaper, the Perth Journal, from 1898 to 1904. Perth was assigned the zip code of 58363. Okay, and once again, it sits on 83 acres. All right. Let's see. Perth is, what year did it, it was founded in 1897. So, it's 2023 now, 1897. So Perth is 126 years old. So what has made Perth sustainable for 126 years? Now, they had a newspaper. It didn't start off with a newspaper, and it doesn't have a newspaper now. But what's made it sustainable? Well, that's where we go to the informal economy. So let's look up what is the informal economy. And large governments typically do not like, you know, like a New York City, Chicago, Illinois, or Los Angeles, California, Orlando, Florida. Those are large local governments. They typically don't like informal economies or DIY, do-it-yourself economies. Example. In Washington, D.C., you cannot drill in your backyard a well and have your own private water supply. Why? Because they don't, Washington, D.C. doesn't want you to be that independent. Now, you can buy all the water you want from them through their municipal water system. Another example is propane gas, you know, which you can cook food with and all that. In Washington, D.C., unless you cook outside, you cannot have a propane heater or a propane stove in your home. Why? Because Washington Gas, the local private monopoly who basically had the council and the mayor's office write the legislation and pass it, banned it. The use of propane indoors for cooking and or heating your home. However, it borders Washington, D.C., and one of the sites borders Prince George's County, Maryland, and Montgomery County, Maryland. And in both of those counties, you see the suburban propane trucks going to individual homes to supply propane, where people can cook and can heat their homes through propane. So like I say, many large governments on the local government level, not all, but many, do not like informal or DIY economies. All right, so let's go to, which is another reason why I recommend go rural. Now, you got to do your research on rural because not all rurals are the same. But I'm just saying, and why do you think the Amish and the Mennonites and the Hutterites, why do you think they are in rural communities where they have set up towns in rural communities, where they have, set up their markets, their stores, their businesses? Their life is primarily in rural communities, because typically in rural communities, you have informal economies and do-it-yourself economies where you have more individual freedom. Whereas the closer you get to that city, New York, Seattle, what have you, Dallas, San Antonio, those places in Texas, Atlanta, Georgia, those places, Durham, North Carolina, those places, essentially, they're going to start, we got to have a permit for this, on your own house. I was talking to a friend of mine some months ago in Washington, D.C., or somewhere up in that neck of woods. A person wanted a tree cut down in their backyard. The permit to pull the cut down one tree on a personal residence, $7,000. And then, of course, you have to pay the contractor who actually has the equipment and expertise to cut down that one tree. But that's crazy. Give me a rural county where I don't need to pull a permit to cut down a tree. Anyway, so Perth, as well as most of the towns that we feature, have small governments and they have an informal and a DIY economy. You're going to hear more about that practically every program we do from here on out. All right, according to Wikipedia here, an informal economy is a part of any economy that is neither taxed nor monitored by any form of government. For instance, in a county that we're in, we have land in, we do not need to pull a building permit in this particular part of the county. Don't need to pull a building permit. Now, if we want sewer service, we'll have to pull a permit because in this part of the county, they're not offering municipal sewer. Great for me. Now, I'm going to have to come out of my pocket to put in a septic system and I have to pull a permit for that. I'm all right with that. But I'm not going to get a bill month after month after month on sewer trees. All right? Because I'm not taking municipal sewer services or nothing like that. Anyway, and it's all perfectly legal in that county. All right. Now, let's see. Although the informal sector makes up a significant portion of the economies in developing countries, it is sometimes stigmatized as troublesome and unmanageable in places like big cities like New York City. In New York City, if they're not getting a cut in the form of taxes off you, it's not, it, they consider it illegal. It's not that way. And you have to look at this too. The United States houses only 4% of the world population. That's it. The United States only houses 4% of the world population. 96% of the United, I mean, excuse me, 96% of the global economy exists outside of the United States. But there's a lot here in that 4%, though. So that's where we're getting these tiny towns from. So the informal economy, also known as the informal sector, also known as the gray economy, is part of any economy that is neither taxed nor monitored by any form of government. Although the informal sector makes up a significant portion of these economies in developing countries, it is sometimes stigmatized and troublesome and unmanageable. However, the informal sector provides critical economic opportunities for the poor. Okay. Integrating the informal economy into the formal economy is an important policy challenge, and that's for your larger economies and densely populated areas. Okay, like for instance, in Vietnam, you know, they set up barbershops on the sidewalk barbershops, no permit needed. Over here, you got to go to barber school in most cases. You got to get a permit pulled, and, you know, you got to get a shop. Then the shop's got to be zoned this. You got to get a permit for that. You got to get a business license, occupancy permit, all that to cut here. Whereas you go on other, and you know what, here's the thing. In the United States, 75%, 80% of a haircut, hair service is done for men and women. 75% is done inside somebody's home. So only the people that actually pull a permit and have a brick-and-mortar place for hair or a barbershop or monitor. Let's see. Solar barbershops. We've talked, you know, we got to set up one of those now. There's no regulation on solar barbershops in the United States at this moment. All right, let's see. In many cases, unlike the formal economy, activities in the informal economy, also known as the DIY economy, are not included in a country's gross national product, GNP. Okay, let's see. All right, we're going to cover this every week, and if not, almost every day. Because what we're doing is anyway, it exists. It's a big economy. And like I say, the bigger the government, the bigger the local government, when you got to get a permit for this, got to get a permit for that, those are typically bigger towns, and they don't like the DIY economy. Whereas a smaller economy, they don't care. So you can do what you want to do in that particular jurisdiction legally with no hassle and with a peace of mind. All right, and that's all part of gray economy real quick. Let's see. All right, gray economy. Okay, let's see. Women in informal economy, but I'm looking for a gray economy. What is meant by gray economy? The gray economy includes any economic activity that is legal, but which is unrecorded and unregulated. That's the definition we're getting here. These transactions frequently involve arbitrage opportunities where there is disparity in price points across geographic regions. At least once a week, we're covering these. Gray economy, informal economy, and DIY economy. They overlap. They overlap. Let's see. What is the gray economy, also known as the unofficial economy? Okay, the informal economy is a diversified set of economic activities, enterprises, jobs, and workers that are not regulated or protected by the state. This concept originally applied to self-employment and small unregistered enterprises. It has been expanded to include wage employment and unprotected jobs. Now, in a municipal economy, and man, I got to take notes on myself. Okay. I'm thinking out loud here. Right? Municipal economies. Municipal economies, they supply you with protections. Like if you're a landlord and nobody's paying rent, and as a landlord, you have registered your building, you've got a business permit, you got a certificate of licensing, you passed all the inspections, and that local municipality says you're good as a landlord. If that tenant doesn't pay, one of their protections within the municipal economy is they have rent court. So you go to rent court and say, look, so-and-so's not paying our rent. I need to help municipality in getting these people out. So that's the – now, in an unincorporated area, you're not going – where you don't have municipal services, or let's say municipal economy, that's not going to happen. I'd rather take my chances in a non-municipal economy. Let me see. Right, municipal economy, gray economy. I'm taking notes as I'm discovering stuff here too. Economy. Let's see, we have informal economy. So a lot of you out there that are listening, and with all that marching and protest and bullshit, you're living in the wrong place. Let's see, informal economy. Let's see, and then, okay, we have DIY. 24 hours ago, I didn't know. I knew something about municipal, but I got it more defined now. Let's see. Okay. All right, so every week, we'll be going through the, do you want to live in a informal commodity, a municipal economy, a gray economy, an informal economy, or a DIY economy? All right. And I like the gray, informal, and DIY because they will overlap. I love those economies because it's easier to operate, as I would call, as an American. All right. Your larger cities, it's harder to do. But everybody's got a different point of view, different mission, different lifestyle. So, you know. Okay. So Perth, North Dakota. I'm sure they have an informal economy. They're over 100 years old. And the informal do-it-yourself economy up there has worked well. And matter of fact, I want you to do this. I want you to get in your search engine and type in Mennonite communities in USA, in the United States. And we're going to open up the phone lines here in a moment. The Mennonites, the Amish, and the Hutterites, those communities operate to a high degree in the cross sections of the DIY economies. Amish, those three, they don't go out and get jobs. They create their own jobs within their own families. But if you go in, let's look at, before I go to the phone lines, put in Mennonite communities, USA, and then let's see. Then or put in any search engine list of list of states by Amish or list of states by Mennonite. And what you're looking at when you know your computer starts buffering is you want to look at and you'll see that the majority of, like I'm looking at two different maps of the Amish population. That's it. All those, one's in green and different tones of green, and then one is in gray and blue. All those places are rural areas. Now, that's Amish. So right here in the United States. Now, if we look at it, if we type in any search engine, Mennonite communities global. Let's do that. Communities global. Let's see. All right. Well, I'm on Wikipedia. I'm trying to find, because if you see a Mennonite map, because they have Mennonites in Russia, they have Mennonites in North America. Now, when we say North America, there are Mennonite communities in Canada, the United States, and Mexico. All right? You also have Mennonites in, okay, wait a minute. All right, Mennonites and, well, let me read the list. Let me give you the numbers. Now, I'm not a Mennonite, but I'm borderline. I'm not for the wardrobe. I'm not knocking it because I'm a shorts, T-shirt, sweat hoodie, baseball hat, sweatsuit type of guy. That's me. All right. But other than that, I'm borderline Mennonite, okay, or Amish, borderline. I mean, I'm not going to grow the beard and all that other stuff, but, you know. But, all right, so let me give you the, let me run this down and go to the phone lines. There are 2,130,000 Mennonites globally, as of, based on the 2018 figures. It's probably more than that. In the United States, here's the breakdown of that. All these figures that I'm going to give you,
These people live in rural communities. They live in gray economy areas, geographically gray. They overlap gray economy, DIY, do-it-yourself economy, and informal economies globally. So let me read the numbers here, then I'm going to the phone lines. And I follow what they do. There's no sense in reinventing the wheel. Okay. So in the United States, there are 500,481 Mennonites. And you might see one walking down Fifth Avenue in New York or 42nd Street in Manhattan. But you follow them home, it's going to be on a farm or a Mennonite community or Mennonite town in upstate New York, New Jersey, someplace like that. India, they're in India, over 257,000. In the United States, in Ethiopia, over 310,000. And in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, in the middle of Africa, there's over 225,000. In Canada, Mennonites. And they have a German base. Amish, Mennonite, and Hutterites all can trace their roots back to German. And in their local languages, there's a German dialect in there. Canada, 149,000. Indonesia, they're everywhere but Antarctica. Bolivia, 26,000. Angola in Africa, 30,000 plus. Mexico, over 110,000. Back to Africa, Kenya, over 35,000. Paraguay in South America, over 36,000. And Germany, home base, over 47,000. In Zimbabwe, Africa, over 50,000. Thailand, over Asia, 63,000. Tanzania, back to Africa, 66,000 plus. And in those countries, like, let me name it. All right, let's break this down. Out of Mennonites, over 2 million globally. Okay. Now, Bolivia, Angola, Mexico, Kenya, Zimbabwe. All right, hold on, let me count it. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. All right, out of the earth, let's see, 11, 8, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15. Out of 15 countries that you can find them in, 12 of those countries are developing countries. Old school people might say third world countries, but today they're known as developing countries. So out of 15, and then out of the developed countries that the Mennonites are in, they are in rural areas. And in rural areas in the United States, that's where you're going to find the informal economy, and like I say, they overlap the informal economy, gray economy, and DIY, do-it-yourself economy. Those are some major success clues. So that's why I say, me personally, I'm an urban black dude. You know, that's how I grew up. But now that I've seen the light, I'm country. All of it. So, in Seattle, Washington, the average price of a house in Seattle, Washington, is $1 million. And then more than likely, you got to come up with a 20% down payment. That's $200,000. And then if you don't have all the money, then you got to go to a bank or some type of government program. You know, just teach me how to build a house, and I'll just build my own house debt-free. All right, enough of my rant for today. I'm going to the phone lines. Let me find my way back
to the studio. So, no, wait a minute. Give me a moment. And I'm dealing with my, I got a knee brace on today, but I can walk. I got a man. Anyway, I'll probably be brand new by Monday. Oh, my phone is buffering. Hold it. No doubt. All right. Give me a moment. Try again. Okay, here we go. All right, finding my way back to the studio. So, you know what? Monday, that's Monday's podcast, unless something else comes up. We're going to be covering the gray economy, the DIY, and the informal economy. And essentially, they're all practically all the same. They overlap. And whatnot. So let's go to the phone line because I'm off my rant now. 309, Chris Collins, your mic is open.
Good morning, L.A. So I hear you're in a knee brace. How's your knee doing, though? You feeling?
Oh, yeah. I can. That allows me to. It wasn't that much pain, but there's less of it. And then I can walk better. So, I figure by Sunday, Monday at the, most, I'll be back to normal. Because today I'm going to start putting heat on it.
Nice. You know what? Put some cool on it. Because that'll help. The heat, if it's got a heat in it, like if your injury, say you're just sitting there feeling it and it's warm, there's an infection
uh-huh.
in there.
Okay.
So, that's where, just try an ice pack.
I'll do that after the podcast. I got the ice and I got the thing to put the ice in. So I should do that.
Yeah, but most definitely keep your knee brace on. I got my knee brace on, and it's causing me to be able to walk, and have the confidence.
Yeah, I can't because I normally walk fast, so I can't. I figure, well, let me just because I've been basically staying put. Like this morning, I can walk to the bathroom in the house, that stuff like that. But I walked to the mailbox this morning. So I was able to navigate that. I couldn't walk as fast as I normally do, but that's okay.
Yeah, don't push it. It just happened yesterday.
Yeah, I'm not pushing.
Give that thing some rest. Our knees are very resilient things because they move around. Luckily our kneecaps
right.
move and things like that. So. There, it's just whether, or not you wind up, hurting the tendons or tearing them. And you didn't do that, We're dealing with soreness here.
No, so I would have felt that.
You'd have felt
if
that.
If I tore a tendon, I definitely would have felt that.
Oh, yeah, when I pulled my hamstring, I felt it when it happened. I was like, ooh, well, that was a stretch. I ain't never did splits in my life.
right.
I felt my muscles just give up, But I think we got Dr. T in the house with us this morning.
Yeah, I just opened up her mic.
Awesome. How are you doing this
morning?
Good morning,
Dr. T. Dr. P. But if she's listening. The mic she might be muted or in a conversation stepped away. But her mic is open.
Good morning.
So,
can you hear me?
Yeah, now we can hear you. Yeah.
You can. Good morning. We heard you. No, we don't hear you. Okay, well, her mic is open, so it.
Yeah, I was gonna say she's there for a moment. She probably pushed the mute button back on her phone on accident. There she
it's
is.
It's my earplug technology. I keep telling you, Chris, you know this. Technology and me, you know, we have this love-hate relationship. But I was listening to the two of you, and, you know, I often tell people that everybody, 100%, without exception, will be disabled at some point in their life. Depends on how you look at it. So you two are both having knee issues.
Yeah, I got one now. You're right.
Right? I have ear knee issues. So, you know, if we look at just disability, if people looked at it like we all have it, it would completely change the connotation entirely. Anyway, I just thought I'd add that. Good to see you, and
well,
I love
I'm
the information.
You know what? I'm glad you brought that up because you're right. Everybody, nobody gets through life unscathed with some type of disability, like Robin was bringing up yesterday. I've been doing this for like 9.5 years, these podcasts, so I haven't been sick, no colds, no pneumonia, nothing like that. But yesterday I fell. I was trying to get away from a pig, and I slipped, and my head hit a coffee table. Now, I broke the fall, but in the process, I sprained my neck, shoulder a little bit. I hit the coffee table with it. I hit right below my nose, but above my mouth, and that split open. And then I hit my knee. Of course, all that helped break. I mean, luckily I fell just right because that fall, nothing didn't crack, so to speak. But now I'm sitting here with a knee brace on. So, with that said, with these communities that we're setting up, I think we need to look at what can we do for first aid as well as the disabled, because you can become disabled in a moment's notice.
Absolutely, L.A. I had an individual that I was helping. He was a professional football player and got in a car accident and ended up being a paraplegic and could not get. He had just gotten home to his apartment after several months of rehabilitation, and he couldn't get out of his apartment. And so we called our organization and said, I just want to go outside. Can you help me get outside? I'm like, how simple is that? Within,
you're right.
I don't know, within 12 hours, we had the Centers for Independent Living out there with a ramp, and he was outside. I mean, it's that simple. And I'm so grateful that when you fell, you caught yourself in it, you know, it didn't end up to be a major issue. But my best friend for years, her husband got thrown from a horse. He's a high school coach, math teacher, very intelligent. They own a ranch in Wyoming. They were out herding cattle, getting ready to do some branding. And he got thrown from his horse. Major brain injury, and he's never been the same. And so,
well,
you know, we look at these things.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, that happened to Christopher Reeve.
Exactly.
Yep.
Exactly.
Superman.
And
Superman,
so when we look at these things,
horse.
And I used to tell the teachers that I worked with, if this were your child, that you're served to teach, how would you want them treated? If it were you, your individual, and that's why I guess I'm so passionate about building these communities where they don't just go and sit in a room and do, you know, watch TV, but they actually have activities and social communities, recreation and leisure activities, you know, canoeing, whatever, that they could do without just being kind of left on the wayside. So that's kind of what I was thinking.
Right. Well, you're right. This is a big, we're going to have to do some podcasts on that on a consistent basis. Cause, you're right. Everybody, you don't get through life unscathed with some sort of disability. It might be temporary, but, you know, once you, you know, because you got to figure out what can I do. And it depends on the disability. Like, if one of the people that we've had on, he might be listening now, had a stroke, but he does speech therapy. So he's, matter of fact, he sounds normal now, but that caused some type of, other people, if they have a stroke or whatever, it might affect their mobility. And they had to work their way, you know, through that. So there's all kind of ways in which a person can become disabled. And then we have to, because you know what? There's a lot of disabled people that are living in some of your large cities, but their monthly income, including any disability check, isn't enough to cover expenses. Matter of fact, aren't you guys covering that with your project on 41 acres with veterans? Is that part of the plan?
Yes, veterans are included in the property development, absolutely. Veterans, elderly, okay. Adults with disabilities. And if you look at it, you know, that's a visual disability, right? We can see you guys limping. That's a visual temporary disability. I want to talk about PTSD, of which I have been diagnosed with. PTSD is a situational or temporary disability, but it's invisible. Does that make my disability any worse or a lesser disability than yours? Absolutely not. And if you think about women, you know, children, women, boys, men who have been engaged in, you know, sex trafficking or, you know, forms of violence, domestic violence, and they suffer with that, they're still going to need those resources and tools to get past that. Many of them do. I have. I needed support to get through that. And they're often misunderstood by society and community. So even those individuals, although they're invisible disabilities and they're temporary disabilities, have a right to come onto that site and get the supports they need as well.
Okay. You're right. You know, that's one subject I really don't, we all have known and seen people because there's so many different disabilities out there. You can probably set up a whole village, town, small town that'll, like I said, there's so many different types of disabilities. Sight, you know, got all sorts of physical. And then, matter of fact, I saw a picture yesterday of an auto mechanic. They showed him doing his job, but he has no legs. But he's a fully certified auto mechanic and obviously with a disability, but he has not allowed that disability to stop his, he has the craft of auto mechanic, so he hasn't let that disability, paralyze what he can and can't do. So, Alexa, we'll cover that more often. So now, you see, it's Friday. You have a clubhouse house today or room or what? Dr. T.
Yes, we have a room at 5 o'clock. It's on Clubhouse. And Chris also, I believe, has a room today. Chris, what time is your room on today? Can't remember.
Chris? He probably stepped. He's here, but he's probably doing something.
I think his room is usually around 2 o'clock Eastern. So either one of those, we come in and we talk about not only the communities we're building, but we help connect people to the support, answer questions about disabilities, and just be a resource for information.
Now, what's the name of the define you specifically at 5 today on Clubhouse? What room or the name of the house?
Parents in Power.
Parents in Power, okay.
Mm-hmm.
And while I got you on air, all right, I've been on Clubhouse. I haven't been on there recently, but for a little over a year. When I got on there, they didn't have houses. So what's the distinction between a room and a house on Clubhouse?
You know, honestly, Ellie, that's a great question. When I first got on, which was probably in October, they were rooms. Everything was a room. But I started
a house. Yeah, I can navigate those. But a house,
well,
I've been able to navigate those yet.
Right. Well, I started a house because of the confidential nature of what we talk about sometimes. You know, it's up to the parents on what they want to disclose, but I didn't want it to just be out there for people to just pop in and hear a little bit of information and take it and go. You know, I wanted to protect the information that the parents were sharing and so forth. And so I started a room. Well, in January, I think, they turned They turned all of the rooms into houses. So there aren't rooms anymore. They're all houses.
No wonder I haven't been able to. Because when I go in there, I'm looking for people I used to listen to, and I can't find them. Okay. That explains
that's
it.
Why. So tell me more about this Mennonite villages. I'm really interested. I was Googling that when you were talking.
Yeah, if you, well, matter of fact, let's see. Let's go back. So just go to, let's see, Mennonite Communities, or let's say, yeah, Mennonite Communities Global. And let's see, on Wikipedia, they have a Mennonite page. And they, their maps too, but... essentially, the Mennonites, they look like Amish people, you know, as far as dress, and their lifestyles are very, very, very similar. I believe, matter of fact, the Mennonites were first, and then the Amish is an offshoot of the Mennonites. So the Amish men, at least the married men, have beards. They had straw hats. Mennonites, Amish, they all related. All right, but here are the distinctions. Mennonites. Well, let's start with the Amish. The Amish. First thing, all of them live in rural communities. All right. Now the Amish. They do not drive motor vehicles. They have limited use of modern technology, so they're not driving a car. But in their rural communities, they have horse and buggies. That you know, they're farmers, and they use old school farming technologies, or whatever.
cell phones, tablets, internet, and all that culturally is not permitted within most Amish communities, because they have different sects and denominations within the Amish. Now, the Mennonites, they use modern technology. Oh, by the way, now, the Amish might use solar panels. Some might use solar panels now. And some of the younger Amish are riding electric bikes. The Mennonites, they do use cell phones, smartphones, computers, electric vehicles, including electric bikes. They, you know, laptops, desktops, internet connection. They'll use that. But just like the Amish, some of the common denominators is most of their marriages are entrepreneurial-based families. In other words, the husband and the wife are entrepreneurs. They were raised by entrepreneurs, and they were trained to look for entrepreneurs as mates, and they had best businesses. I think Chris is wrong. So with Mennonites, like I said, if you look, list of Mennonite communities, they got them all over the globe. They have maps, and you can, and they're all essentially, and they're within the gray economy, informal economy, and DIY economy, which all three of those overlap. And it's all documented. You guys, it's online with a lot of information, as well as the videos.
Chris, I don't know if you know, we can hear you. But so I asked that, Ellie, do you happen to have what their, like what their mission is, or what their vision, you know, does it say something about, you know, their beliefs when you look them up? I don't have access right now.
Well, they do have it. I'll read what I have here. It says beliefs and practices. Now, this is, all right, all three of those groups spring from Anabaptism. So what is Anabaptism? Anabaptism is spelled A-N-A-B-A-P-T-I-S-M, Anabaptism. So I'll read through that, right? The early Anabaptists, it's a Christian movement which traces its origins to the radical Reformation, which I'm not going to go through that right now. Right? The early Anabaptists formulated their beliefs in the Confession of Faith, I'm not even going to try to pronounce that. Okay, let me see. Anabaptists believe in the baptism. Where are you holding? Now, this is all coming out of Germany, by the way. All right. All right. The name Anabaptist means one who baptizes again. Let's see. Lineage. I'm skipping over a lot of stuff here. Let's see. Let's see, history. All right, you have, I guess they're out of Switzerland originally, but they have Dutch Mennonites, South and Central German Anabaptists, Swift Brethren, and Moravian Anabaptists. These are all offshoots of the Anabaptists, which eventually gets into the Amish, the Mennonite, and the Hutterites. Let's see. I guess they speak some form of German. Let's see. They went through persecution sites. Spirituality. All right, so the root of it is, like I say, Anabaptist, but Let's go to, all right, with Mennonites, the name is derived from the founder of the movement, Mino Simmons, of, Friesland. Well, where's Friesland to be exact? Friesland is in Europe, up by what we call today the Netherlands. I see you got, it's over 2 million of them worldwide. Now, once again, what I pick out of them, because there's a lot on, is their entrepreneurial base. I mean, typically their marriages, the husband's an entrepreneur, the woman's an entrepreneur, they were raised by entrepreneurs, they were brought up in entrepreneurial families, they have family businesses and family industries. That's what I cherry pick out of those, you know, group of people, the Mennonites, Amish, and Hutterites. There's a lot more to them than that. That's what I just picked. That's what I cherry picked out of. Oh, and they mostly live in rural areas, and they start their own towns.
You know, I think
they got them in Russia.
A lot of what's that?
They have Russian Mennonites as well.
But the foundation of their beliefs and their way of living is through love and gift and giving away, right? Helping others, being of service, and caring for those around them. Am I correct on that?
Yeah, you're right. Mm-hmm.
And not violence, not injustice, not political gain, not even really wealth gain. When they begin their entrepreneurial in adventures or businesses, they do so because they've identified a need that their community needs. If it could be
right.
used to bring income to their community, then of course they'll go out and they'll sell their wares, but they don't market. And they certainly don't market under the name of Mennonite necessarily, at least not that I've ever seen.
You're absolutely right. You're 100% right on that. I'm glad you brought that up because what one of the things I like about the Amish, Mennonite, and Hutterites, you know, you got a gazillion books out here on personal finance, how to get rich and real estate and all this other stuff. But somebody has written, but I have not seen one book written by a Mennonite, Amish, or Hutterite that talks about wealth building. Not one. They're low key like that. Very low key.
Because their focus, their bottom line purpose is to help those around them, not for personal gain.
Right.
And believe
right.
that the more you give out, the more you receive. As service, I'm going to call it service. I don't even know disciples, I want to say, but, you know, and then to be of service to other people as opposed to financial and personal gain. But you're right,
right.
You know, and that's why I love these communities. And I think it's very.
You won't see them driving around in a Bentley. you will not see. They live very simple lives.
Absolutely, and that's what I love about that, and the communities that we're looking to build is very similar to that. It's not for our financial gain as far as New Hope Advocacy as an organization. We are a service, nonprofit service organization, and as I said, everybody, 100% of the people in this world will be disabled. So even though we say at, you know, New Hope advocacy for those with disabilities, that includes everyone. Everyone. If you have a need, if you need an ice pack right now, LA, I'd go get you an ice pack. You know, that's what we do. And I think that's why I am drawn to those, the Mennonite and communities such as that, because they are a service community, not a get-rich-quick kind of all-about-them community. And that's what we're trying to be.
Oh, yeah, they're not in the world. Right, right. Now, you're from, what, Wyoming?
Yes, sir. Yes. I was born and raised in Wyoming.
That's a wild little state. I haven't visited that state yet. But I imagine out in Wyoming, you have a lot of do-it-yourself people out that way.
There is a lot of do-it-yourself, and if you don't do it yourself, you have a neighbor that'll come help you do it. That, you know, that neighborly helping each other out, it's very much like that. The area that I grew up was a very small community. I could go anywhere in the community, and if I got in trouble, my parents knew about it before I got home. Or if I needed help, parents knew about it before I got home.
Right. All right, boy, that's a fast social internet.
Well, and there wasn't internet back then, and there weren't cell phones, and there weren't selfies.
Right.
It was, you know, and we're talking back in the pre-technology type days. We still had TVs that you had to get up to turn the channel.
No, I remember those. Black and white TVs at that. And now, like one of my favorite, series on Netflix, Longmire, that takes place in Wyoming. So because I love landscape, so I like the landscape, you know, that they occasionally show you out there. Now, isn't there a mountain range somewhere in the state of Wyoming? Like Rockies or Teton Mountains or something like that?
The Tetons are part of the Rocky Mountains, yes. The Tetons are in Jackson.
Okay.
Yellowstone, of course, is right up there as well.
Now, like I said, I haven't been to that state. I've been to Utah and saw the mountains there, but I need to make a trip out to Wyoming. Because that's also geographically is one of the largest states geographically. But I think Vermont has the least populated state, and Wyoming is somewhere. There's not that many people in Vermont, Wyoming, is there?
There's not, and you know, Wyoming people who move there that haven't grown up there. It's very. It's a harsh land. It's a brutal land in the winter times. The winters are blowing and drifting snow, blizzard conditions. Roads are closed often because there's too much ice and snow, and they can't get the snow plows out to clear it enough for the traffic to go through. We've had winds, hurricane. I used to laugh when I was there, because the winds in Wyoming often are equivalent to an F1 tornado. It blows a lot. The wind blows a lot, and so it's just really interesting. I'm not there now because I got tired of shoveling snow and scraping windows, but it's always going to be home, and it is. Difficult, the water level, if you were to buy a piece of land, you have to drill quite a ways to get to the water in Wyoming because of the elevation.
Well, it seems like it would be a
beautiful
good place
stuff.
To have a retreat or whatever here, because the landscape must be fantastic out that way. Now, you have how many reservations are out there in Wyoming, you think? Native American.
I'm trying to think. I know there's the...
you know, I can look that up right now.
There's the one in Riverton and Lander. That's the Shoshone and... I believe there's one in northeastern Wyoming, up near South Dakota.
Okay. And typically, a lot of those reservations are massive. I mean, some of those land, reservations are huge as far as their land coverage is concerned. Matter of fact, I'm looking at Wyoming right now, and there's a huge one that takes up, I would say, a certain percentage of the state. It's, let's see, what this would be, 20 to 35% of the state of Wyoming can take, well, that's how big this reservation is. Which I'm sure those are interesting places to visit. Well, it seems like it will be where it's... Oh, matter of fact, let me see. Wyoming population. Okay, 578,803 people. That's the 2021 census population of Wyoming. But I like that number because you have cities that I look at a place like Wyoming. That's how people are supposed to live, because when you have 578 people crammed into a city, I think that we're not supposed to be living on top of each other like that. That's just my personal opinion. But if you have it spread out, it's better. And the state of Wyoming has a distinction of being the least populated state in the United States. And I guess, like you said, Dr. T, that people can't handle that winter. Well, anyway, I got to visit. That's on my list. Okay, so anybody else with any announcements? Dr. T has a 5 o'clock p.m. Eastern Standard Time room on Clubhouse. Chris Collins, I believe, has something at 2 p.m. on Clubhouse. Any other announcements before we sit down for the weekend? Or 6-1. Oh, Tony Bennett. That's trending news. Tony Bennett, the crooner, the singer, the entertainer. He passed away at 96. So, well, you know what? All right, I forgot to bring this up. This is on our headlines. Steps you got to take. Step one, whatever you want to do. Form a macro town, small town, whatever. Step one is start where you are. Step number two, use what you have. Like the example we've been given this week of the guy Brigham, who founded the town of, Everett, Washington. He had 160 acres worth of land, and he didn't have electricity, because electricity, as we know it today, was not around. I mean, it was around, but we didn't know how to harness it at that time. So we had no electricity, had no power tools. But he used what he had. He did what he could with what he had.
and he was able to build the log cabin. There was no Home Depot, Lowe's, Menards, but he managed to put it together. And from that, now Everett Washington has over 110 people, I mean 10,000 people. So essentially it all boils down to just start where you are, use what you have, and do what you can, and then the universe will take care of it.